You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for February 20th, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from beautiful downtown Witch's Tit, USA. It's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Just so people don't think that we're being sexist here, that's actually from Thomas Pynchon, Gravity's Rainbow.
Science fiction. Yeah.
Colder than a witch's tit, colder than a bucket of a penguin shit, colder than the hair on a polar bear's ass, colder than the frost on a champagne glass. So, and he probably got it from eons
his mom. Before
that, but
from a guy at a bar.
Yeah, cause... it's attributed to Thomas Pynchon. Okay, and it's cold.
It's cold.
It's cold.
Baby, it's cold. And you know what? We've got all of half an inch of snow on the ground here. So
we do. Poor yeah. Boston. I feel so. You know, I lived in Boston for 14 years, so
yeah.
I have been through snow and cold there.
Yeah.
Many yep. times, but
and I lived in Chicago for many long years and lived through many blizzards there, and I feel for the good people of Boston who are digging out from under just a staggering amount of snow.
Yep.
Less so for the people of New York, because you know it's just they're so snobbish anyway. You
know? Well, that's the center of the universe. So
it is.
I love our New York City listeners. I have many.
I do too.
In New York City, so. All right, today's episode is, or this week's episode, is entitled, May You Allow Me My Opinion.
Yes.
And this came out of, I'm going to give a little background, Dinesh Divorsa Despausa.
Yes.
Had just an awful tweet this week. I'm not going to read it, but it mentioned the word ghetto and boy in reference to our president.
Uh-huh.
The president's picture of him with a selfie stick was ghetto and boy. And a lot of people pointed out to Dinesh that selfie sticks aren't exactly ghetto.
No.
And that he is a convicted felon.
Yes. Way more gangster than the president.
Gangsta.
My friend. Yeah.
So, but in the responses to this horrible racist tweet that Dinesh D'Souza still has up.
Well, maybe you're the real racist, Blue Gal.
Okay. Yeah. There was a person who shall be nameless because he might be 12 years old. I'm just not sure. Who made a series of comments about Barack Obama being the worst president in history. And everything that he said to quote unquote back himself up on this came straight out of Sean Hannity. I mean, it was Hannity parroting.
It was just wrong.
But it was straight out of Hannity. This guy listens to Hannity all day long. So, but there is a man, I believe it's a man, on Twitter named Ferd Berfel, after the Laugh-In character, who apparently had really had it with this kind of afactual spouting of Barack Obama's the worst president in history.
Oh, I feel I've been there.
Yeah. And he just said, look, you haven't Googled Teapot Dome. And, you know, Johnson, the first Johnson actually started the Civil War. His policies led directly to the start of the Civil War in the United States, which killed a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
And he went on and just really kept hammering, you know, I don't think Barack Obama's the best president ever by any stretch of the imagination. But to say he's the worst is just a denial of history.
Uh-huh.
And this person who as Ferd Berfel said, I don't know if you're a troll or an ignoramus, but.
Or a drunk or a child.
Or whatever. Who knows? But this guy finally replied to Ferd Berfel and said, May you allow me my opinion along with many others. Thank you.
Yeah.
And that's when Twitter, you know, said, no.
No.
You can't have your opinion when it's wrong, when you are actually factually incorrect.
Well, you can. And you can have it in the privacy of your own basement if you'd like.
Yep. And never and never publish it.
Well, yeah, and if you want to hang your big dumb jaw out over the internet and say stupid things in public that are just begging for someone to come back at you on, I mean, there's what do you expect? It's a public forum. Yeah. If you wanted your private dumb opinions,
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no.
As I've said, it's the bulletin board at the grocery store.
Yeah,
you know, anybody can put something up there. It can be as offensive as anyone wants to. Someone might come and try to take it down or report you.
Yeah.
But it's out there. And it is subject to criticism from other people, whatever you say.
Yeah.
A lot of young people don't seem to understand that. They think, well, that's my private tweet. There is no such thing as a private tweet.
No, there's not. Well, and you can block people.
Yeah.
To my eternal pride, I was blocked by raging internet asshole and Hollywood star Nick Searcy. but I did exactly the same thing. He was just saying incredibly offensive, racist, dumbass, ignorant shit. And I just spent about half an hour, 45 minutes, just pushing and pushing and pushing. You're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. And the original post was, look at this pussy who blocked me because he didn't want to hear me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the punchline is, after I debunked and humiliated his minions and humiliated him over, made him cry like a baby, his response was to block me.
Yeah.
So you know what? You can have a certain degree of privacy on the Twitter if you really want it, but it is inherently a public forum. This is what my blog was visited by the spirit of Connor Friedersdorf.
Not the spirit, the actual Connor Friedersdorf.
Because I wrote a little toss-off post. There was a follow-up to another post about the essential laziness of the open letter to people who are never going to listen to you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tom Friedman writing, "Dear Mr. President, if I could write the State of the Union, here's what I'd say." Shut up, Tom Friedman. No, everyone knows what you're going to say. It's dumb, and no one's ever going to say it. So it's just lazy. So Connor Friedersdorf had gone through this whole thing about wanting to ban the use of the word conservative and force those conservatives to explain what they mean in detail, thus missing the entire point of having the word conservative out there to begin with. So that was my introduction. And he had this other one where we should have better manners on the internet. Internet mobs should just not be tolerated.
You mean like the blogger ethics panel?
Yes,
is that what
there
you're
should be a blogger.
About?
Yes, well, blogging's dead, so we have to have a Twitter ethics panel, I guess. But it was part A of his article was about how internet mobs are irresponsible. They cost people jobs, and they're just out of control, and they're vicious and awful. And B, and corporations should behave better too. Corporations should be pressured into doing things, et cetera, et cetera. And I answered him in two parts. The first being essentially, it's like writing an open letter to God about it being cold outside. Mm-hmm. It's completely lazy, ridiculous. Addressing the internet and saying, "Hey, internet, it's me, Connor Friedersdorf. You should really be nicer to people." It's just lazy. Okay, I agree with you, but that it's beside the point. But the second part was the part where I got a little hacked off, which was he and I disagreed about corporations and the idea that corporations are using the internet, using Twitter, using social media to pry ever deeper into your personal life and take over more and more of your downtime, which he did not agree with. He thought that was a result of something or other. But the idea that you can make this inherently rambunctious, riot-prone men's room wall into a polite place where people will behave themselves is silly. It's not going to happen. So the idea that your opinion, however well-formed or poorly formed it might be, is going to just pass unnoticed. When you pin it to the wall, you're asking people to have an opinion about it. You're asking for a response to it. And I don't think that has been gotten through to people, as has the fact that whatever you're writing out there, that's going to be with you for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Your future employers are going to get ever more sophisticated algorithms to find out what you were saying and what you thought and whether or not you embarrassed your possible future employer, et cetera, et cetera. So I wish it were otherwise. It'd be delightful if it were otherwise, but it isn't otherwise.
And pretending well, and we it brushed is, upon something. We brushed upon something earlier when we were talking about Twitter, about the possibility of this person being 12. There yeah. are a lot of adolescents on the Twitter and on the Facebook and on YouTube comments especially.
Yeah.
And their brains are not wired to regulate emotion with reason. Oh. So, and I think when it's all mixed up in anonymity, we don't know who the adolescents are, literal adolescents, and who are the figurative adolescents in the conversation. No. So that also tempers what your opinion of the internet should be. Mm-hmm. I want to get to an article that was brought up in Daily Kos. It's actually the original yes. articles from the Washington Post.
Uh-huh. And this is, again, under the general category of why can't you just let me have my opinion?
Why can't you just let me have my opinion? Mm-hmm. 37 years old, fifth generation Republican, Texan, opposed to Obamacare because it's just another government handout. Then she got divorced and she lost her health insurance. She has a new job that doesn't offer insurance. And mm-hmm. then she got sick.
Uh-huh.
And she...
This is
might
can
have
I just point out,
life crippling medical bills, you know.
This is like the opposite of a letter to Penthouse.
No. You know? All right.
I never thought this would happen to me, but one day.
Well, yeah, I never thought this would happen to me. I never thought I would have huge medical bills at 37 because I have a blood disorder.
Exactly.
And so a friend of hers said, look, you've really got to check out healthcare.gov and see if you can get some insurance because you are sick. And you're going to need it. You need insurance. And she was able to get health insurance for $89 a month. Okay, so now she has coverage and she doesn't want to lose it. So she wrote to the governor of Texas and said, if you're going to do away with the subsidies, I don't want to lose my coverage. I can't afford to pay a full price for my health insurance. She said, I can still feed my kids and put gas in my car. I'm not trying to go to Cancun or carry a Michael Kors bag. I drive a 2009 Mazda, and I'm just trying to make it in my little apartment and not be on government assistance.
And that last part is what
that last part was the razor in the apple for me, because she is on government assistance.
Honey,
she's
you are on government assistance.
From Obamacare to pay for your insurance. Now, I personally don't like it that the money from Obamacare is going to private insurance companies.
No.
I think that's horrible.
Yes.
But this is the solution, that the political solution that came out of the Congress to make sure that you have health coverage. And Barack Obama's opinion was, I'm agnostic about how we get there, but we have to get everybody covered. And that means working white Southern Republicans.
Right.
Will
who
have.
Don't go to Cancun.
Who don't go to Cancun or carry a designer handbag.
Now.
Will have health insurance.
Unbundled.
Even
that.
If they unbundle think that's that. Government overreach.
Yeah.
And well, as soon as I read that too, I said, okay, we've won. Because now Obamacare is like Social Security. Yep. It's not a government program. I earned this. I pay a premium every month for this.
And she does.
It's $89 and the marketplace price is over $200 a month. And you can't afford that. Mm-hmm. You know, this,
I bet the meds are
mine.
Equally. Yeah. Yeah. No, she and there is.
This is an entitlement. Right.
But if you unpack what she's saying, and I don't know the woman, I'm not going to judge her heart and soul. But if you unpack it, what she's saying is, I'm not undeserving.
Right.
I'm not one of those undeserving people.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm not wasting my money on extravagances and lavish things. I have a simple life. I'm hardworking, and I don't want to be on government assistance. Well, first of all, honey, you are on government assistance. Mm-hmm. Get used to it. That's what government assistance looks like. Government assistance does not look like a black buck sitting on a street corner eating a T-bone steak, to quote Ronald Reagan. Yeah. Government assistance means working people like yourself who cannot afford to live in the country that has been created around them, being given a little bit of help to hang on and try to live a decent life and raise their children. That's all it means. But because you're a white lady, a Republican lady from Texas, and you know in your heart you don't spend money on crazy things like Crown Royal and going to Cancun, then you deserve this help. Mm-hmm. And those people don't. And that's what this is all about. This is all about class and race.
And privilege. Yep.
And privilege, absolutely. I deserve this because dot, dot, dot. And that's why she doesn't want her opinion unbundled in public.
Yeah.
Because her opinion is ludicrous. Her opinion is legitimate. I mean, the idea of, look, I'm doing the best I can, and I just need a little bit of help from the crushing load that insurance, that the private market demands of me, because they don't care if I live or die. And the government is there to say, okay, we're going to give you a little bit of help. We're not going to build you a palace. We're not going to provide you with the first rate, best healthcare money can buy, no matter what you want, but we're going to give you a little bit of help, because that's what government should do. It should be that little bit you need to get by if you're not independently wealthy.
Well, in Drift Class, I think it also is, we should do this in a way that doesn't saddle the taxpayer with emergency room visits by women like this.
Absolutely.
Whose rare blood disorder and uninsured means they go to the ER.
Right.
They should have a regular doctor. And this was the whole point of Obamacare, was to save money by giving people primary access to primary care physicians with insurance. Mm. And but so that, I don't think it's selfless of the government to say,
no,
we think everyone should be insured. That actually saves money and keeps hospitals running.
But with great respect, that argument never played with conservatives.
Right, right.
Because it was, well, those people should just basically die anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
There are emergency rooms, let them go there, screw those people. They didn't care about the cost. This was never about cost, because it was other people. It was about these moochers who want free stuff.
Free stuff,
and,
yep.
That's why we
Bill
should
Bill O'Reilly said, yeah.
That's why we should be drug testing people on welfare. Mm-hmm. That's why we should look over their shoulder every time they use a link card to buy anything. And that's why we should withhold health care from them if they don't meet our standards of proper
whiteness.
Whiteness. But you're right. It's becoming, I don't think we're quite there yet, but it's becoming Social Security. Four or five of her neighbors are all in the same situation.
Yep.
Where they can talk about it without a sense of shame. Like, oh yeah, I got on the healthcare.gov and I got great insurance. Oh, I'm so relieved. As opposed to, I feel ashamed. I had to go begging to Uncle Sugar and Obummer for, because it's nothing but shame. It's something, but they've been taught that asking anyone for anything makes you one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, you live in a country where if you'd like to get from A to B, you've got to ride down roads that I help pay for.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you live in a country where we depend on each other.
Yep.
Government is not an alien force. Government is us doing collectively what we cannot do individually. I think I'm misquoting Lincoln, but don't we all?
Well, that's always the argument that I have about Social Security, is this is America. We're a wealthy country. We take care of our seniors.
Yes.
We take care of our disabled. And when you put it that way, then you defy Uncle Liberty to say, no, I don't want to take care of anybody but myself. Well,
right.
Okay.
Right.
You know.
And veterans, because I was a veteran. You know, there's always that additional
tribalism. We talked about that earlier.
Yeah, but there's always that additional category to include in people who deserve help.
Their tribe.
Because my neighbor Jim Bob was one of those guys. So, but you know, if you legitimately were disabled, you know, if you're one of the good ones, then that's okay. But it's all those bad ones out there. And you're right, it's straight up tribalism. And it comes from and the fact that we have this thing called the internet, and we have access to information at a level that is unprecedented in history. It's an age of miracles and wonders. retaining that sense of tribalism, retaining the protective, ablative shielding of ignorance that lets you continue to believe this nonsense is exhausting. You have to work at being a moron in America today. You have to work at hiding from the truth in America today. And that's what conservatives are so pissed about. It's getting harder and harder to sustain their stupid beliefs. And they're getting pissed off. So they start doing silly things like saying that Barack Obama.
This is what I want you to get into, this article in The Atlantic. And let me be clear to our listeners before you start, Driftglass.
Yes.
I don't like spending a lot of time talking about people who are not elected officials and the crazy things they say, because I think it is a distraction from real issues like Keystone XL and Social Security and the minimum wage and those kind of things. And, you know, Rudy Giuliani spouting his mouth off is not news to me.
No.
But this trend that has really come out this week with Dinesh D'Souza and Giuliani and Eric Erickson and all these folks really getting racist, the distraction is a story now. And so tell me about this article in The Atlantic. Well, I'd like to hear about it.
And these non-elected officials are the lenses that shape the discussion. They're the ones that shape and focus the elector, the conservative electoral opinion.
I also think that there is an understanding that they are there to distract from GOP congressional fail. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But Giuliani said Obama doesn't love America and doesn't raise the like we were. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Giuliani decided he'd just go full tilt bigot and talk about how Barack Obama doesn't love America. And okay, everybody got hacked off about that, but it's part of a trend. It is, and there's this long article in The Atlantic that the first two or three paragraphs I have no objection to. It's this one sentence.
What's the name of the article? Do you have it there?
I really should because I just did a post about it. I should remember it, right?
So I should go to Driftglass and look for it. Okay.
Yeah, go look for a very silly article in The Atlantic.
All right.
By Driftglass.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
What does it mean for Obama to love or hate America?
Okay.
And it's this very long article about Rudy Giuliani and others. And I'll just cut to the chase. But Giuliani isn't the only person to make this claim. And others aren't just fringe figures. Eric Erickson, who I consider a fringe figure, but who am I? Hailed by The Atlantic as America's most powerful conservative, says Obama hates America. Former presidential candidate Steve Forbes doesn't think Obama loves America. Nor does prominent Tea Party organizer and once and more and likely future presidential candidate Rick Perry has his doubts. It goes on and on like that. The Erickson-Giuliani consensus is important in that it requires a measure of malevolence on Obama's part. And this is the part where I part company entirely with the author. Therefore, it makes sense to look at what evidence they marshal for the view to see what it is, what it can tell us about them and about Obama. No, it can't tell us anything about Obama or about them that we don't already know. And the reason is it's not 1982 anymore. The idea that we should examine this and rake through the coals of this and look for the root cause of this is bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know who these people are. They're ghouls. They're bigots. They're morons. They're lunatics. That's who they are. And every time certain elements of my liberal media and my mainstream media are confronted just with the barefaced fact that that's who they fucking are, they can't look at it. They can't cope with it. So we're going to analyze it. We're going to think about it. We're going to try to ascertain what they really mean. What does this evidence tell us about that? No, that day is long gone. The idea that we have to keep mounting proofs and mounting theorems and mounting some sort of intellectual framework to understand what's really going on here is nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to figure out is how to get rid of these people. How to drive these fuckers out of power. How to exorcise this horrible demon from our body politic forever.
Well, and Driftglass, the way I would argue we need to do this is not to get distracted from the failure that is the GOP Congress. I think we should pull a Newt Gingrich, as I've said many times, And every time a Democratic congressman or senator goes before a microphone, they need to say, aha, we see again that Republicans don't know how to govern.
Yes.
They can't get Keystone passed. They promised up and down they would. They can't do anything about the president's immigration. Now, a crazy judge has halted the implementation of this temporarily, but all the articles I read today said it really is, it has no precedent that this will get overturned. And it's a matter of how and when it gets overturned, not if. But there was an article, there was an editorial, an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times today, I believe it was, about immigration and the trap that Obama set for the Republican Party, and they just walked right into it.
They do that, don't they?
He said he's a registered Republican. This is Tamar Jacoby, who is president of Immigration Works USA, a national federation of small business owners in favor of immigration reform. These are the Reagan people. You know they are.
Uh-huh.
Who Reagan gave amnesty to immigrants for back
No, he didn't. La, 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 la,
yeah.
la, la.
Yes, he that did. And happened. So did Bush, too. Bush 41. Mm-hmm. These small business owners, they want immigration reform. No, they want cheap labor.
Yeah.
But this Tamar Jacoby, registered Republican, said, oh, yes, the Republicans are right. The president overreached. But being right isn't always enough in politics. You have to win the war of perception. And right now, the GOP is losing that war big time. Americans aren't hearing the message about the president's abuse of authority. They're hearing that the GOP says it hates immigrants.
Yeah.
And I added to that, the base won't let them say anything else. Don't forget, right. It's the Iowa caucuses.
Right. The lawless president who hates America,
keep saying that, but also you have to talk about amnesty and you have to talk about illegals and you have to talk about the border, you know, and locking up the border again. You cannot say the truth, which
I agree that every time a Democrat steps in front of a microphone, mm-hmm. They should read what I give them to read. Because Newt Gingrich gave them a list of words to use. And I think there is if Democrats were ever that
organized. He gave his people. He gave Republicans a list of.
Yeah, he gave the new Republicans. He gave the incoming freshman Republicans.
Last people 94, wanted to, right.
He taught them all how to give them all a list of words. Here are the words you always use when you talk about Republicans. Here's all the words you use when you talk about Democrats. Democrats were traitorous, coward, welfare, red tape, bureaucrat, all the horribly weak words, adjectives he could think of. Mm-hmm. And it would work just as well with Republicans, because it's true, but it's never going to happen because Democrats are not capable of organizing themselves in that way. Just fundamentally unable to say, look, let's all get together and for the next month, every time we're in front of a microphone, call them corrupt, incompetent vassals of the Koch brothers. Mm-hmm. Just do it, just for fun, just for a month, just for Lent. For Lent, let's give up being disorganized weirdos. Let's all get together and say the same thing in the same way on every microphone. Just see what happens. But I do have one minor nit to pick with you over the fact that Giuliani and Erickson and those people are not elected officials.
Okay.
We're not elected officials either.
Well, that's true.
We're a bit of a distraction, but
yeah, that's true.
I'm okay with that.
I'm okay with that, too.
Yeah.
I don't want to be although I do think you'll be mayor before you die. But
hey, don't
tell
me.
Then you'll have
mayor?
To tell those kids and the rock and roll to go to sleep.
I was mayor once. I was mayor for a day.
In Iowa, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a little town in Iowa, I was mayor for a day. So I've done that. I've been on TV.
I've been mayor. I'm not going to do it. It's like...
yeah.
It's like Jim Morrison and the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done the Ed Sullivan Show.
Actually,
it's a little bit more like Fast Eddie Felsen in The Hustler. You know, I can't go back to Chicago. Some stuff happened there. I can't go back.
Can't go back to that little town in Iowa.
I can't. I made off with some funds, and I can't go back.
Well, you and I do not Well, yes, we do. Never mind. I was going to say we don't start flame wars like saying Obama hates America, but we kind of do from our own perspective.
You know what? I can sit down. Here's the thing. Let me give you a little anecdote of something that happened to me recently.
Okay.
I was going back and forth with a colleague, mm-hmm. Long time ago, some time ago, about the Iraq War, the single defining feature I think of our generation, certainly mm-hmm. the Iraq War, and suddenly, Barack Obama is being called the same names that we were calling George Bush. And being referred to in a much similar way.
Yeah.
And I pointed out that that's really ironic that you're using this epithet for the Obama administration when that's what we called the Bush administration for lying us into the wrong war.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, here's a thought. Let's stop the insults for 5 minutes and let's relitigate this shit. And let's talk about how you believe this bullshit and how you call people traitors who didn't agree with you. And then 2 minutes after Bush was gone, you swore you never heard of him, and your country was lost because Barack Obama. You know, the whole Tea Party arc of it helps every now and then to just sort of jump in the middle of that, because there's a whole protective shield that goes up about not talking about anything having to do with anything that happened before 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever you can get in a reference to the fact that, hey, where was all this passion for deficit reduction when George Bush was destroying the economy and bankrupting the country? Where was all this passion for executive circumspection and not behaving like a tyrant when George Bush was lying us into the wrong war? And the comeback was, well, it was certainly Bush might have been bad, but it was the Democrat-controlled Congress that was equally bad. And I had to sit there for a minute and go, what Democrat-controlled Congress? I defy you to look up the Congress as it existed between 1994 or 5 and 2006. And there was a period in there where Tom Daschle was going back and forth because I think it was Jim Jeffords switched parties.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a resignation. And Daschle was, I think, president of the Senate for like 2 minutes at the end of the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Gore was 50-50. But the House was run by Newt Gingrich,
yep,
and Denny Hastert during that time. And it was Trent Lott. You know, it was. And so I'm like, what are you talking about? And it was very clear quickly after that it was time to change the subject.
Yeah.
Because you caught me being factually wrong about something. So I'm not going to, I'm a conservative. I'd rather blow my fucking head off than admit I'm wrong. So we're just going to change the subject. But what was clear was that the internal reality landscape was such that because everything has to be both sides,
mm-hmm,
because I am congenitally unable to accept responsibility for the shit I did, I'm going to invent a history where Democrats are to blame for half the shit that we did. And I'm going to stick to that right up until someone puts a fact in my face and proves me wrong. And then I'm going to run the fuck away from
that. Well, then, aren't I allowed to have my opinion about whether the Congress was Democrat or Republican?
And that's my point.
Yeah.
When I start a flame war, I can sit down and show you with facts and history and logic and all that evil liberal shit exactly why I reached this conclusion. The only way you arrive at the conclusion that Barack Obama hates America is either you're drunk or you're a lunatic or you're a racist or you're an asshole or you're Newt Gingrich. A little bit of all these things. And there is no chain of evidence that leads you to that conclusion. You conclude it because that's what you have to believe, because you were sucked George Bush's dick for 8 years and you can't live with that. So it is imperative that Barack Obama must be worse than George Bush. Because by comparison, if Barack Obama is better than George Bush, if liberals are right about shit, even a little bit, what does that mean? What does that have to say about your vision of reality? Your entire identity falls apart. So Barack Obama must be worse than George Bush. Ergo, Barack Obama must hate America. Barack Obama must want people on welfare. Barack Obama must not be the president of the United States. It's reasoning backwards from a position of complete psychotic break from reality. And that's what conservatism is. It's nothing more than that anymore. It used to be economics and tax policy and all these other things. But right now, it's just a manifestation of a deep terrifying psychosis on the part of people in such deep denial about who they really are and what they really did. They invent shit out of thin air, and there's a whole media infrastructure designed to take their money and give them the lies they want to hear. It's called Fox. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to start a flame war on my side because I got the shit to back it up. You can't start a flame war with a conservative because eventually the truth pops out of the ground and they run away. But they never change their mind. That's the thing. They never fucking get it. They never change their mind because they can't. And that's why we have to drive this out like an exercised demon, as opposed to construct a theoretical structure by which we can examine the evidence about how they arrive at this conclusion. No. No. Those days are over. I'm sorry. I'm off my soapbox.
No, I just wonder at what point does someone like Rudy Giuliani wear out his welcome, because Sarah Palin's worn out her welcome. Really? And there are, yeah, she has. I mean, she gets to go on Saturday Night Live.
She does, doesn't she?
Because she's a celebrity, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. But apparently Giuliani tonight on Megyn Kelly was going on and on about Reverend Wright. You know, it never stops.
Oh. Well, Giuliani...
And at what point do you just say, Rudy, you know, you're an embarrassment to everyone?
He's not. I mean, he went on, remember when he went on Meet the Press and talked about this, you know, this astoundingly racist bullshit poured out of his mouth about black crime.
Oh,
remember
yeah.
this?
Yeah, I remember that.
His career should have been over. I mean, if Alec Baldwin's career could be terminated for
because
saying...
he called a man who shoved a camera in his child's face. Yes.
Right. That's the standard. By the way, speaking of internet mobs, if that's the standard, mm-hmm. the Rudy Giuliani should be out of a job, but he's not.
Right.
And none of those people are ever out of a job. There's no depths to which they can sink on national television. You know, Meet the Press is not part of Fox News just yet. It's supposed to be the gold standard for where we go and have reasonable discussion, which it isn't, and it hasn't been for 10 years at least, but that's what it's supposed to be. Rudy Giuliani can go take a shit on a desk in front of Chuck Todd and
Chuck Todd will say, well, you know, both sides, you know, have poop that smells. Next. Rudy, I will tell you that Nancy Pelosi's poop probably smells just like yours, Rudy Giuliani.
Just as bad, maybe even worse, you know. up next, the Seahawks. Hey, let's talk about that. So, and Giuliani can walk away from any catastrophe he creates and walk into his next job. Mm-hmm. He only wears out his welcome when he starts to alienate the base. Mm-hmm. When people who are loyal Fox stooges and loyal Republican voters start going, oh, shit, this guy again? That's when he's worn out his welcome. And he hasn't worn it out yet. He's reliable.
Stuff going, then...
No.
Yeah.
Shit, Hugh Hewitt still has a job.
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe Rudy Giuliani and Hugh Hewitt will be on that conservative cruise in 2017.
Yeah.
That'll be fun.
Yeah.
All right.
The things you see, as my friend used to say, the things you see when you don't have an attack helicopter.
You have... you have 4 minutes and 40 seconds to talk about David Brooks.
Oh, you know what? I don't want to talk about David Brooks. Here's the only thing I want to say about David Brooks is this. He wrote a column citing a book about PTSD and about how hard it is and how tragic it is and how the trauma of PTSD screws with your sense of linear time.
Okay. He's right. Yeah.
You keep looping back. My only wish would be that the scumbag architects of the war in Iraq would wake up screaming at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Would wake up terrified, would start mistaking overhead fans for chopper blades.
Except they're all on Jeb Bush's payroll, Dirk Glass.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. But they don't.
And
the
debt check's clearing.
Uh-huh.
So,
But the cheerleaders, the guys who put these men and women into this meat grinder from which they came out with their minds messed up, like David Brooks, they never repent. They never admit their mistake. They never have a moment's remorse. They
walk away from it. Well, and this is the really dangerous thing now, is now it's a both-siderism thing between, let's compare Barack Obama's approach to terror and George W. Bush's, because George W. Bush went to war over terror. So that's better, right?
Well, and that's why I'd rather...
It's the wrong country, yeah.
Well, yeah, sure. He boldly went into the entirely wrong country because Dick Cheney told him that's where the oil was.
Yep.
And Dick Cheney's Halliburton made out to the tune of $39 billion.
And who killed Osama bin Laden?
Oh, SEAL Team 6, Blue Gal, SEAL Team 6. Oh, yeah. It's it is pointless to argue. As I've said before, it's like arguing pod bay doors with Hal from 2001. It's pointless. There's no point in arguing with these people anymore. And that's why I'd like to take the last 10 seconds I was going to spend on David Brooks on Jeb Bush.
Okay. Yes.
I've heard a lot of people whining about, a lot of people sort of cackling on the left. My people, my tribe, cackling about what an awkward and forced and silly and goofy and messed up speech it was. And ha, 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 didn't he look like a fool? And ha, ha, ha. No, 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 no. You missed the point. The point of giving a speech like that is not to give a speech like that. The point of giving a speech like that and writing shitty presidential books with two-word titles like Action Points or Go There, whatever the fuck it is. The whole point of doing that, I should say hiring a ghostwriter to write that book.
Oh, and Drew Flesh, you and I could write that book for any candidate in America.
In my sleep with my toes.
Yep. I could. You and book. I could do it. Yep.
You know, because they're gauzy kind of, you know, bio. Mm-hmm. They're just bricks of paper with notions in them about what the candidate would like to do and how much they love America. And that's great.
How much they love America. You need a lot
I got to say, the exception is Barack Obama's biographies. He wrote them himself, and he's a very good writer.
Yeah. Yep.
But by and large, this is what George W. Bush did. You give this speech, you talk about your foibles, you talk about your marital problems if you're Bill Clinton, you talk about drug use in passing, you have your spokesman do it, you give some shitty speech or write some dumb book, and then from then on you just say, oh, I've covered that already.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I covered that in my major foreign policy address. Why weren't you paying attention? Go look at my book, go read my book, go check out this chapter of my book. And you never have to answer the question again. Mm-hmm. Now, I question the need, because the whole idea is you give a speech like that in front of a friendly audience. Mm-hmm. And then the hostile reporter comes up and asks you hard questions, you just say, well, look at my speech. I've already covered this in my major foreign policy address. The flaw in this reasoning is that we don't have aggressive reporters anymore.
Yeah.
We have Chuck Todd, who doesn't want to make you mad because you might not go on his show anymore. So there's really no
And he has a lot invested. Chuck Todd has a lot invested in making sure that this next election is a horse race.
Yes.
And every election is a horse race. A lot invested in that. So it can't be that Jeb Bush is an absolute failure right out of the gate.
No.
He's got to be propped up till October, November, so that the ratings, because of ratings. Yeah.
Oh,
so,
and you and I remember, we are cursed with the curse of long memory.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember how Sarah Palin was the flavor of the month right up until after the Iowa straw poll.
Right.
And
right.
Then her, because that was all her campaign person promised her to get.
No, not Sarah Palin. You're talking about Michelle Bachmann.
Michelle Bachmann. I'm sorry. Yeah. I do apologize. I get them confused. Yeah. the whole point was to get her through that utterly meaningless straw poll and then dump her. And then it was Rick Perry. Rick Perry was going to be the guy. Yep. But it was all these people who were definitely gonna be a comer, and they had some zazz and they had some charisma. Did you see them talking about that? And they all turned into shit. And it was one after another of these people.
It was all the not Romneys, yeah. Yeah.
And it was the mainstream media would fall in love with them, fake love, would paste a smile on their face and call them charismatic leaders for a month or 3 weeks or whatever it is, and then drop them like a sack of potatoes. And they move on to the next one because they needed it to be a content. They needed their story. And the story couldn't be that the Republican Party cannot field a competent candidate with both hands and a roadmap. Yeah. That they're out there digging up Nixon's corpse. They're so desperate.
Yeah.
So it
yeah.
has to be that, you know, that Newt Gingrich, that spry young man
from
Georgia.
That guy who won the Georgia Republican primary in 2012. Yes, he did.
With his wife behind him, beside him. That is his wife, right? Yes, that's his wife. Yes, Phil, that's his wife.
Well, that was his mistress for 6 years, and then it was his wife. Yeah.
But
extramarital mistress for 6 years.
You get the impression, nobody's going to talk to me about this, but that everyone knows what's going on. This is about Newt Gingrich creating buzz for his production company and his wife's videotape company and the next shitty book he's going to produce.
And, Driftglass, I will say that I have learned everything I know about how to properly eat a corn dog in the Iowa caucus from Callista Gingrich.
Yeah, see.
She had strong opinions about that. You don't put it in your mouth. You put it on a plate and you slice it. Mm-hmm. And what I want is when I put it on a plate and slice my corn dog, I want Newt Gingrich sitting right next to me.
Yeah, yeah. That's my 50 Shades of Gray, my friend.
That's my 50 Shades of Gray right there. Oh, all right. Hey, no Bible bitch this week, but what are you giving up for Lent again?
I am nobly giving up hassling Andrew Sullivan for 40 days.
That's nice.
Yeah.
But he's not blogging anymore.
That, like, does God ask that question? No. I didn't read the fine print anywhere in the Bible about having to give up something that doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
So
right. It's like giving up rutabagas. Okay.
Yeah. So no, I don't care what you say. No Andrew Sullivan till Easter.
I'm going to give up worry.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm going to try not to worry for 40 days. How about that?
Okay. That's a good...
Focus on the good things for a while. Yeah. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Phony Baloney.
Really?
He likes to chew shoes.
Uh-huh.
We've known cats like that in the past.
And we have.
Yes, we know about shoe chewing. Yes, Phony Baloney is chewing a shoe on the Facebook page and website. Go take a look at Phony Baloney, and thank you for sending him in. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Unions, letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. Driftglass, we got a donation this week from someone who sent us a note saying, I am a retired postal worker. Keep doing what you're doing.
It's our honor, sir, or madam.
Our honor, sir. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. And please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you.
And I'd like to add the part about getting your email and reading it, because... I'm a bad correspondent, and I don't really have a lot of time during the day anymore, mostly evenings. But I got to say, having responses to our podcast that range from, holy crap, you're going to do 15 minutes of Science Fiction University, what a waste of time, to oh my God, Science Fiction University, I love that, It is,
there is a wide-ranging response. Most of it positive.
Yeah, yeah.
We do sometimes get everyone, oh my God, you're talking about Better Call Saul. Don't do that. And then I squealed when you wrote about Better Call Saul, when you talked about Better Call Saul. Oh, that's so great. Thank you.
Because this is not a rigorously produced show with a schedule. It's very carefully produced. My wife is a wonderful sound editor. It makes me sound much better than I actually am every single week. But it's a...
This is the Napoleon Dynamite School of Podcasting.
Exactly.
Hey, Drift Class, what are you going to podcast about this week?
Whatever I want. God! It is a different chemical mixture every week of us talking about what interests us. And
right. And it's a continuation of a conversation that we are constant. This is what our marriage is like, people. This is how we communicate with each other all week long. So you're catching an hour of it,
yeah,
and we're putting it on the air, but we love each other, and we talk about politics a lot. So
I gotta say, on no Saturday mornings when I have made pancakes have I said, is it recording?
Are we on?
did you download the upgrade, because I'm not sure we're recording. So
yeah,
that there's a slight technical difference between then and now, but
just
basically
this Saturday's pretty nice.
This is who we are. This is who we are during the day, and this is who we are at night, and so on and so forth. So take us all in all.
He's a good good
wife.
Hey, Drift Class, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Obligal, the internet kitties would like to thank the Academy, and of course the cast and crew and their agents and their mom and dad and Jesus and all the little people who cleaned out their litter box. They remember when they were just little kids. The teacher told them they should have pursued a career in cinema.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey dovin'. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Love Podcast is recorded under Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University, we have your question from 2 weeks ago, Driftglass.
I do. We do.
Yeah, we have it. What other canonical work of science fiction is also based on the Count of Monte Cristo, in addition to the abominable Dr. Fives, which is also a canonical work of science fiction, apparently.
Sort of.
But there is a canonical work of science fiction that is based on the Count of Monte Cristo.
Yes.
And the answer is?
The Stars My Destination.
Ah.
Which we're
going to be talking about on Google Plus or something later on.
Once we get the middle child to explain the technology to us, we're going to get on that. We're going to chat about this 50-year-old book that's really very good.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. Probably when the weather warms up a little bit.
So never.
And we have a new contributor tonight to Science Fiction University. Thank you. Paul in Saginaw has written to us and has sent us some excerpts from classic science fiction novels and one short story.
Uh-huh.
And he is reading these himself, and he has a wonderful voice for radio. So I think you'll really enjoy this.
Yeah.
So we're just going to start. He's reading a segment from a science fiction novel, classic science fiction novel.
I'll be the judge of that.
And one short story is in here. There are, I think, six of them. Seven, eight, nine. Okay, there's nine of them. Sorry, I had to scroll down. Nine.
Somewhere between six and ten.
No, there's nine of them. Okay. And he is reading these. So, and again, I think he has a really great voice for doing this. So here you go with number one. And you have to just identify the work of literature and the author, Driftglass.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
Number one.
You know, everything is made up of little bitty things called electrons, protons, neutrons, trontrons, things like that, sort of held together by a kind of binding energy. Now, if you weaken the energy that holds things together, I forgot to tell you they're also spinning around all the time like crazy, or maybe you already knew. You weaken the energy, and because they are going around so fast, all the little pieces start to move away from each other. And the weaker the energy, the farther apart they move. Are you with me so far? I think I am, but I'm not sure that I like it. Keep cool. Now, see my hands? As the energy gets weaker, the ship gets bigger. He moved his hands further apart. It gets bigger and bigger until it is as big as a planet, then as big as a sun, then a whole stellar system. The bloater drive can make us just as big as we want to be. Then it's turned the other way, and we shrink back to our regular size, and there we are. Where are we? Wherever we want to be, Tembo answered patiently.
I have no idea. I should. It sounds vaguely familiar, but...
Okay, this is Harry Harrison, Bill the Galactic Hero.
Yeah. You know, I have a confession to make.
Yeah?
I did not read nearly enough Harry Harrison when I was wasting my youth. Although Harry Harrison's most famous, probably the most famous novel he ever wrote, was Make Room, Make Room, which became...
Soylent Green.
Soylent Green,
yeah.
That's right. So
right.
Everybody's got a little Harry Harrison. He was not the it was not the most cheerful and upbeat book, but there are holes in my knowledge, and you have found one. So congratulations, Paul.
Well, and Paul writes, this novel, Bill the Galactic Hero, is a short and funny parody of the military science fiction genre. The bloater drive is one of the more imaginative ways to get around the speed of light limit. All right, let's try number two and see if you get this one.
All right.
Now, Grant, you can understand what we must do. Save Benes. Why we must do it, for the information he has, and how we must do it. By miniaturization. Why by miniaturization? Because the brain clot cannot be reached from outside. I told you that. So we will miniaturize a submarine, inject it into an artery, and with Captain Owens at the controls, and with myself as pilot, journey to the clot. There, Duval and his assistant, Miss Peterson, will operate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, That's that'd be Fantastic Voyage.
That's Fantastic Voyage by Isaac Asimov. That's right.
Big Ike, and that was Donald Pleasence, I believe, was in that.
Mm-hmm.
And Raquel Welch. Yeah, you can't forget Raquel Welch.
No.
Shrinking down something and sticking it in somebody to do a thing. Very science fiction. Yeah.
All right, number three.
He realized that the glasses were surgically inset, sealing her sockets. The silver lenses seemed to grow from the smooth, pale skin above her cheekbones, framed by dark hair cut in a rough shag. The fingers curled round the Fletcher were slender, white, tipped with polished burgundy.
Oh, yeah, this is Neuromancer.
This is Neuromancer.
Yeah, absolutely. This one made a big impression on me. I went down to the bookstore near the place of work that I was working at in the 1980s on the recommendation of a girl I worked with. And she said, you must buy this book now. And it was brand new, fresh off the press. And I was blown away by it. It was amazing. Amazing work. Still, it stands up really well.
Yep.
Yeah, William Gibson, great author. And although he has sort of tapered off in the last few years, he's sort of declared science fiction to be over. So we'll see.
Well, you've done that too.
I like most writers, I like writing myself into a corner and then writing myself out.
Mm-hmm.
Very good work of fiction, stands up really well.
All right, number four.
In those years when I was particularly eager to communicate with people, I'd work up fearful sweats, trying to plant my thoughts in them. I'd sit in a classroom staring at the back of some girl's head, and I'd think hard at her. Hello, Annie. This is David Selig calling. Do you read me? Do you read me? I love you, Annie. Over, over and out. But Annie never read me, and the currents of her mind would roll on like a placid river, undisturbed by the existence of David Selig.
Oh, man, I don't know. It rings familiar, but I really don't know.
This one is Robert Silverberg, Dying Inside.
Oh.
One of the most beautiful and sad novels in the literary SF genre, now a little dated with racial stereotypes.
I should know this. Robert Silverberg, as Harlan Ellison calls him, Silver Bob, I probably know more about him than books I've read by him, just because I believe he is Harlan Ellison's literary executor or vice versa. And he was always the sophisticated one with the pipe and the pocket and the patched professorial jacket, while Harlan Ellison was always the, asshole at the party.
Mm-hmm.
Or the guy who felt like he was out of place. But they came up together as writers, and I should probably know that, and I don't. So thank you.
All right, let's try number five.
Would you mind telling me, he said to the guide, much deflated, what was so stupid about that? We know how the universe ends, said the guide, and Earth has nothing to do with it, except that it gets wiped out, too. How does the universe end? Said Billy. We blow it up, experimenting with new fuels for our flying saucers. A Trafalmadorian test pilot presses a starter button, and the whole universe disappears. So it goes. If you know this, said Billy, isn't there some way you can prevent it? Can't you keep the pilot from pressing the button? He has always pressed it, and he always will. We always let him, and we always will let him. The moment is structured that way.
Oh, number five. Number five is Slaughterhouse-Five.
That's right.
Kurt Vonnegut. Yeah, you can't. Come on. Trafalmador, Billy, and used to good effect in the TV series Lost.
Yes. Yes.
They mentioned it, and they talked about becoming unstuck in time, which is I miss Kurt Vonnegut. One of the last writers, I think he was able to make a living basically writing short stories for Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
I miss the days when it was possible for a writer to really make a decent living producing a small amount of quality work every year. So
he also taught Rodney Dangerfield about the short story in Back to School. Yes.
He did. And that was a wonderful scene. That made the movie, really. That and having Howard Stark in the movie, Tony Stark in the movie.
Tony Stark as a young punk, yes. Yeah. Yes. And I liked having Oingo Boingo playing in the dorm party too. That was kind of fun. Okay.
Oh, it was a great movie. I mean, I recommend it to people even to this day because Rodney Dangerfield is just a funny guy.
All right. Number six. This one's kind of a tricky one.
Devin carefully pulled himself from handhold to handhold. The light bracketed an iris which seemed to be about half the diameter of the one Devin had encountered in the briar thicket. To the side, white letters glowed on a panel. Access tube, service module. Below the legend, another panel glowed crimson. Devin reached out and touched the second panel. It instantly flickered to green, and the iris dilated open. Head first, as though swimming into a narrow cave, Devin pushed through. Once past the rim of the iris, his eyes were dazzled by a flash of orange light, and once again he possessed weight. Instinctively, he thrust out his arms in front of him as he crashed into a hard surface. His shoulder took the brunt of the blow, and he rolled. Devin found himself flat on his back, looking up, as the iris contracted to a black dot, and then became a featureless disc of metal.
Oh, shit. Okay, I want this to be Robert Heinlein for a very specific reason, but I have a feeling it's not Robert Heinlein.
It's not Robert Heinlein.
No.
And
everybody stop taking a drink.
No, you can take a drink.
Go ahead and take a drink.
But it's not Robert Heinlein.
No.
All right, this is a novelization of the TV show The Star Lost.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, then I know exactly what this is.
What?
And the reason I have a paperback copy of this is... Phoenix Without Ashes.
Oh, for heaven's sakes! You know too much.
Because The Star Lost is this famous awful TV series that Harlan Ellison was roped into doing.
It's Harlan Ellison, yes, and Edward Bryant.
It's and the reason I got tricked into it is there's a famous thing you used when teaching science fiction, and I'm pretty sure it's from Robert Heinlein. I could be wrong, but it's the door irised open.
Mm-hmm.
And they use that. They use that literally in this little quote here. And it's to teach people, stop explaining the gadgets.
Yeah.
Just jump into the story. Go there. And don't, you know, the fact that the doors don't open like normal doors do tells your audience all they need to know about the fact they're in this clearly alternate universe. So I thought that might be it. But The Star Lost was this incredibly shitty television series that Harlan Ellison has written half a novel about, the way that he was treated as a writer, the way he escaped it, the way they just screwed the whole thing up. They really just ruined this Canadian TV series, I believe. But he won an award for his screenplay for it. Oh. And this was the one where he most famously used, I believe, Cordwainer Bird. Because he wanted nothing to do with the shit that it turned into. But the book itself... won a couple of awards, I believe, because it was a very good screenplay. They just turned it to shit, as often happens.
Paul writes, I figured Driftglass might get this because he's a big Ellison fan. Yeah. And, well, you did know it was Ellison once I told you that. All right.
Well, yeah, because...
And you own it. It's on your shelf. So
I do. I own the paperback. So, Harlan, if you want to sign it for me next time I see you.
Not too late.
No.
All right, number seven.
Fontaine glances into the rear of the shop, where the boy is seated cross-legged on the floor, barefoot, his head close-cropped, the notebook open on his lap, lost in concentration. "Who the hell's that?" Clarice inquires, noticing the boy for the first time as she steps closer to the counter. Which somewhat stumps Fontaine. He tugs at one of his locks. "He likes watches," he says. "Huh," Clarice says. "He likes watches. How come you don't have your own kids over here?" Her eyes narrow, deepening the wrinkles at their outer corners, which Fontaine desires suddenly to kiss. How come you got some Hispanic fat boy likes watches instead? Clarice, my butt. Her green eyes widen in furious emphasis, a green pale as drift glass. DNA echo of some British soldier, Fontaine has often surmised, on some close Kingston night, these several generations distant. You move these dolls, or you be vexed. Understand?
This is a word that might ring a bell in your ear.
Yeah. No, I
heard the word driftglass in there, but it's not driftglass. It's not the story driftglass.
It's I want to say Ray Bradbury.
No, this is William Gibson again.
Oh, Bill Gibson.
This is a story called All Tomorrow's Parties.
Yeah. He has slowly, I mean, his later stuff is technically science fiction. I might be confusing this with another one. Here's the thing. The early Bill Gibson, the early William Gibson really stands out in my mind. Mm-hmm. I can tell you plot and character and the whole thing. But the later stuff, I remember enjoying reading it while I was reading it. I remember some of the plot points and stuff, but I couldn't describe it to you in the level of detail that I could with Neuromancer, stuff like that. Uh-huh. I don't know if that's me or him, but it's a thing.
All right, let's try number 8.
All right.
There was a cable across the western entrance to the strait and placed to snag icebergs floating in on the current. He flew directly over the berg jam west of the cable and looked down on chunks of ice like floating drift glass. Then over the black open water of the strait, the biggest stretch of open water he had ever seen on Mars.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Now, see, here's drift glass again.
Yeah. This is Kim Robinson.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. How'd you know that?
Well, it's Mars. There's water on Mars, and it's either Ray Bradbury or it's Kim Stanley Robinson.
It's Kim Stanley Robinson.
And it's got to be the blue one or the green one, if there's a green one. Blue Mars.
Here's the deal. It's the blue Mars. It's blue Mars.
Water.
And Paul says, although referring to any of the Mars trilogy would count in my book.
Yeah.
So you get a point for that one. Paul just reread the Mars trilogy after reading it back in the 90s, and it has held up amazingly well. Very relevant to our oncoming climate change. Kim Stanley Robinson, worth checking out. Okay.
And one of the writers who's good on TV, good at explaining stuff on camera.
All right. And the last one.
Drift glass, I said. You know all the Coca-Cola bottles and cut crystal punch bowls and industrial silicon slag that goes into the sea? I know the Coca-Cola bottles. They break and the tide pulls the pieces back and forth over the sandy bottom, wearing the edges, changing their shape. Sometimes chemicals in the glass react with chemicals in the ocean to change the color. Sometimes veins work their way through in patterns like snowflakes, regular and geometric, others irregular and angled like coral. When the pieces dry, they're milky. Put them in water and they become transparent again. Oh, she breathed, as the beauty of the blunted triangular fragment in my palm assailed her like perfume. Then she looked at my face, blinking the third aqueous-filled lid that we use as a corrective lens for underwater vision. She watched the ruin calmly. Then her hand went to my foot, where the webs had been torn back in the accident. She began to take in who I was. I looked for horror, but saw only a little sadness.
Oh, really? You're going to do this to me? You're going to do this in front of everybody? You're going to defrock me like this in front of everybody? Yeah, this is Drift Glass. This is the story Drift Glass by Chip Delaney, by Sam Delaney.
Yeah, 1967.
A bunch
when you were a wee drift glass.
I was a very wee drift glass. Yeah, there were a bunch of good stories in this. It was a collection of stories. I think one that I remember mostly from the title was "Time as a Helix of Semi-Precious Stones," because it's such a lovely, poetic title.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I actually didn't. People have asked whether or not I got some specific meaning from this story that impelled me to adopt this nom de blog, and I like the idea of pulverized waste glass being turned into something lovely. And so
I have a piece of blue drift glass on my finger. That is my engagement ring from drift glass is recycled silver and blue drift glass. That's very symbolic of our relationship.
Because I'm a cheap bastard.
I specifically went on the internet and found what I wanted and you said, get that. This is what I do all the time to you.
Yes. Yes.
A beautiful tote bag for Valentine's Day.
I ordered it. I'm a genius. Really, I'm a genius.
You're a genius. You just let me go get what I want. So.
I still have a little tiny box of drift glass from when I went to Netroots Nation in Chicago.
Right. There were a bunch
of people there who wanted to meet me, mostly from Steve Gilliard's blog. And I was in a crowded bar, and I was, you know, I was within arm's length of Atrios and Digby and all those people who had no idea who I was. I was just another fan. And so I was, and I believe I typed in FTFY.
Yes, fuck the fucking Yankees, right?
Yeah, in big letters on my laptop, and I held it up over my head, a say anything style.
And they all gravitated toward you.
Oh, you're that guy. And there was this, it was very nice. They had, we sort of met afterwards, and there were like seven or eight people who were really sweet, and they really wanted to meet me. And I was very, I was touched and kind of amazed that they were from all over the country and all different kinds of people. And those were the early days of blogging, and there was something rare and beautiful about them. Not to be repeated, but I still have the little box, and I still think about it every now and then.
Thank you very much, Paul. And we have, I think I still have in the box some more Dogface Herman. And we thank Dogface Herman and Paul and Magnolia E-Publishing, are the contributors so far who have sent in stuff for Science Fiction University. Oh, and deeply appreciate it.
And my first batch of congratulations postcards went out. I've heard back from at least one person, no, two people, saying they got them and yay. So I have two or three more to get out, and I will get them out with a note on the back to you lovely people. So now that I know the U.S. mail works, I will.
You figured that out.
I did. I ran a test, and it worked great.
All right. Well, thank you, Paul, from Saginaw, and thank you, everyone. And have a great week.
Stay warm.
Stay warm.